From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The voters of New Hampshire had their say. Senators Hillary Clinton and John McCain are the winners, the comeback kids. The fact that two other candidates won in Iowa mean there's no clear frontrunner in either major party. The trail stretches on. There are six more contests between now and Super Tuesday on February 5th, and on that day, candidates will have to fight for victory in about two dozen states. Here to give us perspective on the race so far and what lies ahead, we've got Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She's a political science and African American studies professor at Princeton University, plus Michael Dawson. He's a political science professor at the University of Chicago. Hi, folks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, in a word, oh my goodness, it is definitely going to be fisticuffs from now on. Melissa, what do you make of the fact that you have four winners now, two in each party? Is there any clarity that comes out of this?
It's hard for me to make much of anything of it because we were in New Hampshire with a group of students, and I am pretty tired. I don't think any of us expected the night to be quite so long in terms of waiting for results to come back. So what I will say is that there's no question that this is going to be a national campaign, and in some ways that's a really good thing. There's a lot of reasons to have anxiety about two early states getting to have the whole say in the nomination process. And so now, because we've had in both parties some very different results, it does mean that the rest of the country is going to get in on this story.
Let's take a listen to Senator Hillary Clinton and her acceptance speech.
Together, let's give America the kind of comeback that New Hampshire has just given me.
Michael, what kind of, besides the exuberance, what about the challenges facing Hillary Clinton now?
Well, one of the challenges is that she needs to show that she can hold on to a more diverse electorate than she faced in either Iowa or New Hampshire. It's going to be the core of the Democratic Party is still substantially non-white, and we don't know how well Clinton's going to do among those electorates. It's also the case that she still has to worry a little bit about money, although not as much as she would have had if she had lost last night.
What do you mean by that?
There was some evidence beginning to come in that some of her big donors and some of the not-so-big donors across the country were thinking about at least hedging their bets and contributing some to the Obama campaign. She's probably doesn't have to worry about it at this point, particularly given how much she's spent already. I'm sure that this will help her raise money to go into Super Tuesday.
Let's hear a little bit now from Senator John McCain.
I'm past the age when I can claim the noun kid, no matter what adjective precedes it. But tonight, we sure showed them what a comeback looks like.
Now, Melissa, he is the oldest person in the race, 71 years old. He is known on Capitol Hill sometimes for being perhaps a little frank in the way that he states his displeasure. What else do we know about Senator John McCain?
Well, we certainly know that he's tenacious. This, you know, he was called out of this race months ago and kind of slowly came back. But be clear, he did not come back because of himself. He came back because of Mike Huckabee. So Huckabee wins in Iowa, basically delivering a body blow to Romney, from which Romney simply could not stand back up in the short period of time for the New Hampshire primary. McCain's got a long history in New Hampshire. It was pretty easy for him to just kind of go into the hole that Huckabee had made. But these Republicans in New Hampshire are quite different than the Republicans he's about to meet up with in South Carolina and Florida. Just as Professor Dawson was saying, it's not clear whether or not Hillary Clinton will appeal to the black, brown, and urban voters that still represent the major constituency of the Democratic Party, it's not clear that John McCain is going to be able to appeal to the socially conservative parts of the Southern Republican Party.
What about the polls here? You know, there have been many different approaches to polling and to paying attention to polls. And some of the polls showed Senator Obama up significantly over Hillary Clinton. Did the polls do justice to this kind of race? I'm going to ask you first, Michael, and then Melissa.
I suspect we might have close to the same answer, that there's been a historical pattern of African-American candidates such as Tom Bradley in California several decades ago, but more recently in both the Herald Washington elections in the 80s and others, of having large leads and seeing those leads evaporate at the polling booth itself. So one of the things I think as political scientists that we have become used to is taking with a grain of salt large leads that African-American candidates may have in the polls in electorates that are predominantly white.
Now, wait, explain that to me. Do you mean essentially that people say, well, I like a black person in theory, but then in practice I'm not – I mean, what's the upside of even saying that, that there's the – you know, that you want the black candidate if you're being polled?
Well, you know, I think this Bradley effect was at part at work in this, and there is this kind of socially desirability effect of not wanting to live in a racist country or to be a racist individual. But I don't think it's just sort of easy, naked racism that explains how that racial effect works. Remember that New Hampshire is a very white state, as is Iowa, but in Iowa, people vote publicly with their bodies in front of their neighbors in their communities. So once you've stated who you are for, it's hard to move away from it. In New Hampshire, you get to close the door, and any kind of prejudices that might even be sort of quiet or you're not clear where they're coming from can begin to influence you when you're alone in that polling place.
The other effect, I think, of the social context of Iowa is that the degree that emotion starts to take over and a real positive spirit of hope is established, that makes it easier for a candidate like Obama, who's so good at bringing people together. While more a different type of calculus, I think, as Professor Harris Lacewell suggests, takes place when you're in the room by yourself and not part of that community spirit.
Michael, what about the Republicans and African Americans? So far, you haven't really had to deal with a lot of focus on the black vote because, frankly, there haven't been a lot of black people in Iowa or New Hampshire. But we're rolling on towards South Carolina. Are there any of the Republicans, in your mind, going to start making appeals to African American voters specifically?
I'm skeptical that they will. They've had plenty of opportunity to do so, and they have been pretty clear about rejecting those opportunities, whether it's coming in front of a group of reporters and other African-Americans that discuss issues of concern to the black community in a debate or in other fora. I don't think there are going to be too many of the major candidates outreaching to the black community in South Carolina.
Do you agree, Melissa?
Florida.
Yeah, I think they seem to be folding up the big tent. The Republican Party, I think, has figured out that making high-level appointments of African-American Republicans is sufficient to signal to non-racist white voters that the party is not lily white. That's enough to make sure that you keep white Americans in the party. You really don't need African-Americans to vote for you if you're a Republican. You just need them to not show up to vote for the Democratic candidate. So all you need to do is make sure that you've got your Republican base shored up and that the candidate running on the Democratic side is not sufficiently exciting to get the black vote out, and you've got a victory.
What about a couple of other groups? I mean, there's all sorts of demographic groups we could run through, but Latinos, on the Democratic side or Republican side, do you expect with Nevada coming up, there's going to be a big push to try to identify issues of interest to the Latino voting population?
I think both parties, in theory, would really like to capture a large segment of the Latino vote, but it's going to be much harder for the Republicans to do so this time around due to the stances they've all publicly taken on immigration. Former Mayor Giuliani will probably be trying to outreach to that segment of the electorate. But it's going to be very difficult for a Republican candidate due to the fights within the Republican Party on immigration to be able to make the inroads that they may have had and be able to in the past.
Melissa, let me ask you about unions. There's a lot of talk about, particularly on the Democratic side, who will end up affiliating with whom, particularly since Obama, Clinton, and Edwards are all making their play for union endorsements. Any sense of how those are going to pan out?
Well, certainly unions were the stronghold of Edwards in New Hampshire. That was visible even at the rallies. All of the signs were these kind of labor union-based signs. But the fact is, the unions are going to need to back a winner, and they're going to start making some predictions about whether or not they think Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama is most likely to take this Democratic nomination. I suspect that the unions are going to be much more strategic rather than sincere, which is just to say that there is very little difference between Obama and Hillary from the perspective of the unions themselves. So they're just going to try to hedge their bets, probably support both for a bit, and let it kind of fall out until they can decide who's going to be the winner. I suspect different unions in statewide levels will back who they think is going to win their states on Super Tuesday. Everybody wants to be in the winner's circle. And the question is, which one of these two campaigns is going to do the best job of convincing Democratic voters that they're going to be the ultimate nominee? And that's going to be really, really tough given these two outcomes.
Now, Senator Obama introduced a new slogan in his speech last night. Let's take a listen.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of a nation. Yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists as they blazed a trail towards freedom through the darkest of nights. Yes, we can. It was sung by immigrants as they struck out from distant shores and pioneers who pushed westward against an unforgiving wilderness. Yes, we can.
As we say in Los Angeles, si se puede. Is that going to attract anyone new, Melissa? This new theme?
Well, I mean, the one thing you got to love about the Obama campaign is they're going no holds barred on writing some of the best political rhetoric in American history. I mean, no matter what happens with Obama's presidential campaign, ultimately, these speeches, the Iowa speech, the DNC speech, his nominating speeches, I mean, these are some of the really the best moments. Just it's fun to listen to as a political scientist. So will it have an impact on voters? Probably not. I don't think that's exactly how voters make their decisions. But I do suspect that any time you get these taglines, kind of a way of saying, this is who we are, we're about yes, we can. It was a very powerful and I think good moment, because what he needs to do is convince black voters in South Carolina that although he did not win New Hampshire, they can still make the difference in making a winning coalition for him. It is exactly that question of whether or not we can, right, whether or not African Americans can back a winning candidate that is up for grabs. And now he's got the slogan to tell them everywhere he goes, yes, we can.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, guys. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Melissa Harris-Lacewell is a political science and African American studies professor at Princeton University. She spoke with us from Princeton Communications Studios, and Michael Dawson is a professor at the University of Chicago who joined us from their studios. This is NPR News. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've been talking about Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton and Republican Senator John McCain basking in the warm glow of their wins in New Hampshire. Just two contests into election 2008, there has been one clear winner, voter turnout. It has been enormous. For more, we've got Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Welcome, folks.
Hi, Farai.
Well, thank you for having us.
So, Mary, maybe kick this off by talking a little bit about this whole issue of voter turnout. Are you surprised that go ahead.
I'm surprised and I'm pleased. I love to see all these people turning out to vote. And, in fact, it's very news for Democrats because they have all these numbers. And a Republican friend of mine was so shocked by it that he said, look, you know, it sounds like if Mickey Mouse ran for president with these numbers, we'd have a rat for president, because he was impressed with it. And I was happy to see all the young people turn out. And then all the people who wanted to vote and couldn't, like in the Iowa caucuses, because they had to work or whatever it was. But it's just truly amazing, and it's impressive. And maybe for once we will get the kinds of numbers in our democracy outvoting that we've all wished that we could have.
There are millions of people who in the general presidential election don't vote, Ron. Now, is this more critical for the Democrats in terms of pulling numbers up? Or do the Republicans have a huge stake in voter turnout as well?
I think both is true. The Republicans certainly, given the importance of this election and given the energy and the mobilization that the Democrats have been able to display, that it's important for the Republican members of Congress, the Republican presidential candidates, and everybody in between to get their folks to come out and vote. But I just want to echo what Mary said a second ago. I think the most exhilarating aspect of what we've seen in the last couple of days is that in the state of New Hampshire, for example, you had 500,000 people. You have 1 million people in there who are eligible to vote. You've got half of those folks who are coming out to vote, young folks, people who've not participated in the political process before, people who want their voices and their votes to count and to be heard. And that, I think, transcends your Republican or your Democrat party affiliation. It's important that people are getting their voices heard.
Let's move on to the topic of likability. There has been a lot made about whether or not Senator Clinton is warm enough, emotive enough, feminine enough, whether Obama is someone who is just more likable. Is Senator McCain someone who comes across as firm or stern? I mean, you can throw all these adjectives at people. How much does that matter? How much is this a personality-based race?
I think it is. It matters a whole lot, and I understand in past elections the outcome has sometimes been determined almost by whether somebody likes people. I remember in 2000 when people said, Gore's not as likable as Bush, you know, and I remember when Mondale was running against Reagan, they said, you know, he's just not likable enough, and Reagan is likable. So policies matter, politics matters. But people, you know, we just all have gut instincts, visceral reactions to people. And if you like somebody, you're more willing to look at them, listen to them, think about them than not. Now, McCain, I think, there's likability and there's also who's liked. I think the media has favorable impressions from reporters I've listened to and talked to about Huckabee, for example. They find him likable. They find Obama likable. And I think asking Clinton the other night whether she was likable and her response to it, which showed that she wasn't very, very happy as not being likable, it is there. Whether or not voters will tell you that they're voting on that basis is something that's very important, and everybody who's running for office should do everything they can to make themselves appear likable, even if they're not.
It sounds like a Sally Fields acceptance speech. They like me. They really, really like me.
Ron. But Farai, it's an important point. I just want to jump on that, too. It's an important point because I think looking at the Democratic candidates for president, you can't really distinguish them that much by way of policy. They talk about change. They talk about universal health care. They talk about a wide variety of subjects. I think what it comes down to is a question of likability. People like Barack Obama. I'm as conservative or as a Republican as you're going to find, but I find him very likable, very charismatic, very personable, and it's fun to listen to him. And I think that that is what resonates with voters. Do I have a connection with this person? And I think that with Senator Obama, people connect to him given his personality.
But I think it's also dangerous, too, having said that, and I'm as much a victim of it as anyone responding to likability, is because we have had presidents who are likable, but the policies turn out to be terrible. And then people all say, well, next time I'm going to be more careful and I'm not going to react like that. But we do it every single time. So we have to have some balance and we have to sit back and think and not be bowled over. But it's hard to do that.
We're human. But speaking of human and what is innate versus what is chosen, this week the feminist writer Gloria Steinem did an op-ed for the New York Times about Hillary Clinton's viability as the Democratic presidential nominee. She argued that gender is the most restricting force in American life, even more than race. Do you think that she's right, that Mary, that people are going to view gender as this immutable issue in ways that now with Barack Obama they may not see race? Or how do you relate to her?
People who were interviewed coming out of the Iowa caucuses, young women said that, many of them said that it was more important to them to have, to operate on the basis of race and racial progress than it was to worry about their own gender. They actually said that and that they felt better about approaching it that way. I remember Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman in Congress from the North and who ran for president in 72, telling me at some point before she died, that she found that trying to run for office, it was more important to people that she was a woman than that she was black. She was surprised. She always defined herself as having problems based on race. I think Gloria Steinem, who should know as well as anybody, she's paid her dues. If it hadn't been for her, a lot of women wouldn't be where they are now. I think she has a point, and I think it's very difficult to overcome, but I hope it's not impossible for someone sometime.
But see, I don't think that's the case, Mary. I mean, now I'm going to be careful because I'm on with two very distinguished ladies here. But I don't
tell us
think,
about it, Rob.
Yeah, exactly. In my experience, but seriously, I think if you look at a candidate such as Lady Margaret Thatcher, you looked at someone who had a very strong sense of resolve and leadership, and people responded to her, and she also happens to be a woman. I think that if you have a candidate who's running for any particular office here in the United States, if they're qualified and if they have the ability to connect with voters, they will become elected. I just think that there's too much focus being placed on Senator Clinton. Oh, she's a candidate just because she's a woman. She's a member of the United States Senate. She has her own record to stand on. But if people only marginalize her and look at her just because she's a woman, I think that that impedes rather than brings about progress.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying, Ron. I'm saying that as far as Steinem's approach, which is to say that if you had a woman who had the very same qualifications as Obama, that was her point that she
right.
made.
Yeah.
The woman would be having a very difficult time because people would say she doesn't have experience, she doesn't have this, but that there are so many people who want to do something symbolically around race that they're willing to sort of give him a pass. That's the point she's making.
All right.
I'm simply saying that I do think that gender is a problem, and overcoming this whole argument about what women's role should be in this country, in the United States, is very hard.
Very quickly, almost out of time, I'm going to toss this to you, Ron. Do women have to be more steely in a way? If you look at someone like Lady Thatcher, if you look at someone even like Condoleezza Rice, there's a certain degree of backbone that may have to come as a compensation for being a woman. And I'm using that term in air quotes. But do you think women also in politics have to step up and in some ways be tougher?
Yes, absolutely. No question about it. I've been in politics for, 16 years of my professional career. And as an African-American male, you can have all the right attributes and all the right qualifications, but people look at you slightly different for being black. That's a fact. And I have no doubt, again, you two ladies are the experts here, but I have no doubt that that is something that women encounter in the workforce in general, and in politics in particular, that you've got to be steely or perhaps a little tougher just because you're a woman.
All right. Well, Mary, we're going to have to continue this conversation later. Ron, thanks a lot. Mary, Ron, more on the campaign trail soon. Thanks.
Ladies, pleasure.
Okay, thanks.
Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and she spoke to us from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush, and he joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. There are tens of thousands of bloggers who serve up political news, analysis, and opinion each day. They're getting the limelight, but don't count out traditional news media yet. Jeffrey Bennett is our show's web producer. He's got the scoop on how old-school news outlets are keeping it relevant. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, what's up, Fry?
Well, what's up with newspapers, TV, radio stations? Are they trying to get into the digital mix?
They are, and they have to, because, you know, as there's been a decline in print circulation for newspapers and viewership for TV news networks, and so they're finding new relevance online. And so that could take several forms, whether offering up news reports as blogs and offering updates throughout the day, or breaking news online instead of waiting, say, for the next day's paper. And it also means scaling back the level of operations. For a typical TV report, you need a sound man, a camera operator, a reporter, a producer. But this is the second election where ABC News, for instance, has actually embedded a producer, usually a young staffer, with a camera and a computer. And they file reports for the web as they're embedded with that campaign. And it offers greater flexibility and greater access. And we've seen how most news sites these days allow readers to comment at the end of reports. And it doesn't seem so revolutionary now because it's so commonplace, but that wouldn't have happened without the advent of blogging and bottom-up integration as we've seen. So, you know, traditional media outlets still have the advantages of resources and access, but they're definitely biting the style of blogs and bloggers.
And what about black bloggers? How are African-American bloggers digging into this political season?
Well, a lot of black bloggers have had a lot to say about Barack Obama, as you might imagine. The blogger Skeptical Brother summarized it with a post titled, "Hillary defeats Obama, Negroes come back to Earth." The blog Homeland Colors looks ahead to the South Carolina primary and writes, South Carolina is a primary where half the Democratic vote is African American. Thus far, the only people who may not vote for Barack Obama because he's African American are African Americans. There's a fear that the task of electing a black president is unsurmountable. And, you know, from what I've read, a lot of black bloggers are happy that Obama's in the race and that he's a viable candidate and the symbolism that conveys, but they support him with caveats. This from blogger Afronetizen. I fear Obama's fate as a frontrunner. I think about Bobby Kennedy and the fear he instilled in an unknown mass of the white citizenry in 1968. And my concern heightens that much more for Senator Obama. And blogger Michael Fauntroy says he is, quote, not drinking the Obama Kool-Aid. He says in too many segments of the country, both black and white, to express any skepticism about Barack Obama is considered political heresy. So hundreds of blogs, hundreds of opinions.
All right. Give me one example of something else that's popping off on our website.
Well, the model Naomi Campbell sat down with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for an interview that can only be described as unconventional. Chavez called President Bush crazy, said Camilla Parker Bowles was unattractive, and invited Naomi Campbell to touch his muscles. Landis Christian on our blog read that and wrote, it's such a shame that this thing was not videotaped.
Jeff, on that note, we are going to, I looked at that myself. You got to go to News and Views. So, Jeff, yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. Moving on to our bloggers roundtable, a black woman, a former congresswoman no less, gears up to fight for the Green Party nomination for president. We have a lot more on the roundtable, and we have with us freelance writer and blog consultant LaShawn Barber. Her own political blog is LaShawn Barber's Corner. Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and the End of Blackness, she blogs at motherjones.com, plus Wayne Hicks, who writes the blog Electronic Village. Welcome, folks.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome.
So, I'm going to start with you, LaShawn. How do you parse out New Hampshire?
Well, to tell the truth, I haven't been following the day-to-day political drama. I blog about other things these days, but I get the overall picture. Obama has sort of raced out in front of Hillary, although he didn't win in New Hampshire. Is that right?
Well, that's open to interpretation. Deborah, maybe that's a good way to kick it off. Do you think that Obama still holds the upper hand over Hillary, although Hillary won?
This is such tea leaf reading, but yeah, it was so shocking, his win in Iowa. Yes. So even though he numerically came in behind her, I think this race is, I think he is still sort of symbolically the come from behind kid. And I think that Senator Clinton is really, really scrambling. And I think politicians are always grateful for a win, but man, she must have thrown herself, you know, off into the sky if she'd lost these two in a row, she was so defeated. I mean, just emotionally and intellectually, I think that she might not have been able to pull herself together. And she made some terrible mistakes after Iowa, you know, basically dogging Dr. King and saying, you know, the white folks did it and the false hope thing. She was really reeling. And I'm surprised that her supporters stayed with her as strongly as they did.
Which means maybe they weren't mistakes. I mean, her crying on TV might have been a calculated move. And, who knew that women were going to be so sympathetic? Women in New Hampshire, anyway, were going to be so sympathetic to her. You know, that all of that. I listened to a lot of the pundits talk about the New Hampshire primary in advance, and it sure did look like Barack Obama was going to be riding a wave that was going to happen with a double digit win. And then you go and you have to watch that whole where he loses that and he lost. And I was born and raised in California. We have something called the Bradley effect out there. Tom Bradley was the popular black mayor that was running for governor. And all the polls said that Tom Bradley was going to beat his white opponent. And then you wake up the next morning and he lost. All those folks, they lied. The white voters that, you know, would tell a pollster, yeah, he's a talented African-American, you know, brother that's running for office. But when they got behind that curtain, you know, something just didn't let them, you know, pull the button. I will tell you that for me, that's my worry as we move forward now. I just hope that people will truly give him a chance and will not fall for some of the okey-doke that I feel like Hillary Clinton pulled in New Hampshire.
All right, guys, you know what? We are going to go to a break, but we're going to come back with lots more from you and from the blogosphere. Coming up, we are talking again with Deborah Dickerson, LaShawn Barber, and Wayne Hicks. Thank you. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We continue our bloggers roundtable. With us, we've got freelance writer and blog consultant LaShawn Barber. Her political blog is LaShawn Barber's Corner. Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com. And Wayne Hicks, known in the blogosphere as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village. So welcome back, and I want to go straight to politics of a different color.
Today, I am announcing my campaign as a Green Party candidate for President of the United States. It is time for a new beginning for this wonderfully beautiful and amazingly diverse country of ours.
That's former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney announcing her plans. And the former Democrat goes on to say the Green Party shares her views on ending the war in Iraq and protecting the environment. She served 5 terms in Congress before losing her seat in 2006, and she's now one of 7 candidates running for the Green Party's presidential nomination. So what do we make of this, Wayne?
A woman looking for a job. You know, there's... two things, I guess, come to mind. One is there's a more interesting black woman that's running for the Green Party, in my view, and that's Elaine Brown, that had a historical position with the Black Panther Party back in the day. The other thing I make of it is I will forever blame the Green Party for us having George Bush over the last 7 years, because it's because of the Green Party's third-party candidacy with Ralph Nader back in 2000 that, in effect, Bush got the Supreme Court, you know, majority that he needed in order to win the election and be in office. So
you can still start a bar fight over that whole debate. but you do bring up Elaine Brown. It's fascinating. You have Elaine Brown, formerly of the Black Panther Party, running. You have hip-hop scholar Jared Ball. So you've got, with McKinney, 3 out of the 7 who are African-American. Now, the Green Party has had this reputation as a political home for white college-educated tree huggers. Does this shake up that stereotype, Deborah?
If it gets noticed, I think it's not so much a woman in search of a job as a woman in search of relevance. And you hate to go out on a limb here, but I would eat my hat if the average black person pays very much attention to, I think as soon as they hear Green Party, they tune out, they think, you know, limousine liberals hugging trees. And I'm not even sure they'll listen long enough to hear Cynthia McKinney. And I think that those people outside of her home district, if they think of her at all, will associate her with scandal and incompetence. So I think we may be looking at the last gasp of it's, I'm sort of embarrassed for her.
LaShawn, you're coming from the more conservative side of the political spectrum. There are millions and millions of people who don't vote, and there was this huge debate, firefight that went on after Ralph Nader's candidacy. You know, was he a spoiler? Was he someone who needed to be in the race? Is there enough diversity in America's political spectrum? I'm not talking about specific candidates, but are the Republican and Democratic parties big enough to contain the ideological range of Americans?
I don't think so. First, I'd like to agree with Deborah. I do think that McKinney is in search of relevance. She wants to stay in the news. And if she were writing a book or something, I think running on the green ticket would be a good move. And I also agree with Deborah that, you know, this is not going to really get any traction. And it's really a waste of her time and money because, you know, she's, even if she does get the nomination, she's obviously not going to win the presidency. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe she's gearing up for an autobiography or something, or just desperately trying to stay in the news. But to answer your second question, I don't think there is enough ideological diversity in either party to encompass the range of opinions out there. One thing I don't like about either party is this going after the black vote thing. I became a conservative. I'm not a member of either party, by the way, but I came to conservatism because of the ideals that the Republican Party espoused that I found myself agreeing with more and more. If they would stick to the issues and go after people based on those things instead of trying to play these race and sex games and trying to divide people that way, I think that would be a better way to gather more people, so to speak, to sort of represent a broader range of views.
Wayne, I want to actually move us on to another topic. In November, we talked about the Enough is Enough campaign here on News and Notes. A group of protesters has been picketing nearly every weekend outside the home of Deborah Lee, the CEO of Black Entertainment Television, or BET, and they feel the network shows, quote, demeaning and offensive portrayals of African Americans and women. Now the group's asking people to protest the BET Honor Awards this Saturday in Los Angeles. Your blog, Electronic Village, is helping to publicize the protest. Why do you think it's important?
Well, you have to do something to protest what is demeaning characterizations, what is just the visuals that come from Black Entertainment Television, the programming that they put on there. It's just very, very, it's very bad for our children. It's very bad for the adults. It's very bad for our community. And so the idea of protesting either Viacom, the CEO of Viacom, by being in front of his house on Saturdays, or Deborah Lee, the president of BET, by being in front of her house, those were good things. The idea of kind of following along the lead of what's happening with the writers that are on strike in Hollywood and are managing to bring down the Screen Actor Guild's award show, where there likely won't be a red carpet, where they'll just be reading off the nominations. Maybe that same fire can take place with this BET Awards, where the actors, the Black actors that are being honored, will honor the quote unquote picket line and begin to realize that question who's giving them the award, and is it worth really accepting when the types of messages coming out of BET are so destructive to our community?
I was a guest on a BET special, and I will tell you quite honestly that there were a lot of younger people in the audience. I'm 38. These are people who were probably in their early 20s who don't care necessarily what I have to think, since I'm over a certain age. Won't care about these protests. Who are these protests for? Are they for the CEOs? Are they for the young people? Who are you really trying to reach with this?
Ultimately, you're trying to reach the sponsors of BET, the folks that are actually paying the bills and getting them to make a different decision. It worked effectively, you know, earlier this year with the quote-unquote Hot Ghetto Mess show, and ultimately that's what Pastor Coates and the Enough is campaign is trying to do, is to say, you know, stop spending money on this type of nonsense to come into our community.
Yeah, I agree with Wayne. I wanted to piggyback on that. I think what Reverend Coates is doing is wonderful. And, you know, we do have freedom in this country to watch trash if we want to. But
fill us in on Reverend Coates, since you've referenced him.
He is heading the Enough is Enough campaign. I just found out about it because of this segment, actually. In the email, I got a link to his site, and I read some of the goals, what they want to do. In addition to a protest in New York this Saturday, they're also going to be at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. to protest the BET Honors Awards. And I plan on going out there and just showing my support. And I think if you could sort of reach advertisers, let them know what's going on, reach people who are buying these products from these corporations and let them know what's going on, they can make the decision to boycott, to not buy the products. But I think it's a very good thing that and I'm definitely going to get behind it, at least on my blog. I'm going to link and keep my readers aware of what's going on.
Deborah, if you reach the sponsors but you don't reach the young minds, does that make a difference?
Well, I can't concede that if it's not possible to reach the young minds, we don't do it. I think the protest is important even if it doesn't reach the young people. We have to hope that it will. I'll never get over how proud I was of the women of Spelman when they stood up about Nelly and his video. Who would have ever thought that would happen? So I think the protest is about self-respect, and it's about loving this community. And we have to, it was like protesting outside the South African embassies. Whoever would have thought that it would have the effect that it did? So I think it's something that we have to do for our self-respect and our self-love as a community. Even if nothing ever changes, we have to believe that we can reach the hearts and minds of our young people. We did it at Spelman, and then the brothers at Morehouse backed him up. So it's about taking a stand about moral values in this community, whatever the outcome.
Yes.
Wayne, what about the whole intergenerational issue? Every generation pretty much has said you just don't understand to the generation or generations above it. What can you do to bring about more dialogue over what's appropriate, what's tasteful, what's uplifting, all these questions? Is there a way to actually start that dialogue?
Well, I mean, things like this conversation, our blogs, the conversations we have with our own children, with our own nieces, nephews, et cetera, all those are ways to begin that type of conversation. There are some things that are beyond the line, and I guess what I'm suggesting, I think what Pastor Coates and the folks that are in the Enough is Enough campaign are suggesting is that there is some programming on BET that is beyond the line. Whether you are 7 years old, 17 years old, 37 years old, 47 years old, it's just beyond the pale. It's unimaginable that kind of garbage is getting into our homes, and I think that conversation, that finding that common ground with young people, can be done if we make the effort.
Right. You know, I just want to add something. What I don't understand about BET is they show these nasty videos all night, and then like 4 a.m. on Sunday morning, they start showing the religious shows. You know, is this the same demographic or what?
That's the exact moment at which your life is saved. And on that, we're gonna have to leave it there. Thanks, guys. We've been talking with Wayne Hicks, otherwise known as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village. He was at member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com. She was at member station WAMC in Albany, New York. And freelance writer and blog consultant LaShawn Barber. Her political blog is LaShawn Barber's Corner. She was at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And join the conversation. Our online series Speak Your Mind gives you a chance to post exactly what you want to say on our blog, News and Views, nprnewsandviews.org. The mortgage crisis has hit families, banks, the stock market, and the world market. But if you're not into stocks and you're paying your bills just fine, it's not your problem, right? Well, think again. What if your local police department has to make cuts or schools cut the number of teachers because there aren't enough property taxes to pay for the services you used to have? Here to give us more perspective, Christopher Haney. He directs policy and research for the National League of Cities. Christopher, welcome.
Thank you.
So explain the domino effect between mortgage foreclosures, especially ones in the past, and public services in the future.
Sure. Well, you've covered it in short already, which is the key here is the property tax. For local governments around the country, nearly all of them have some access to a local property tax, and the revenues they collect from that are driven by the prices of people's homes. You pay a property tax based on the assessed or market value of your home. And so those monies go to local governments. That's how they pay for services. So what's happening with the home mortgage market and people's home prices is now starting to be evident in terms of the property tax revenues that our cities are collecting. And they're seeing a decline for the first time, or many places are seeing a decline for the first time in some number of years.
Can you point to any cities that already have had this problem or ones that might in the future?
Sure. One of the nation's largest cities, Chicago, already has had to report that its revenue, largely due to property tax collections, has come in at a much lower level than they had anticipated. And so they're talking about a series of tax increases and fee increases and cuts in services, hiring freezes for staff, et cetera. So that's just one example of a major city. Another, Greeley, Colorado, is talking because of something like $2 million in less revenue than they thought, is looking at leaving close to 50 positions vacant in the city that are currently not filled.
What kinds of areas are being hit? Ones with older cities, newer cities, smaller, higher growth? I mean, is there kind of a way of judging if you could be on the block?
Yeah, I think it's largely, it's a story of those that rose the fastest have the farthest to fall. And so we saw during the housing boom, a lot of the nation's metropolitan areas, the cities in those metropolitan areas saw rapid increases in the prices of homes. And so those places are now facing the largest sort of gap, so the places where they can fall. And so we're seeing this in places like Southern California and Florida, where there was a lot of increase in home prices over time. There was a lot of speculative home buying also that was driving up those prices. And so we're hearing pretty dramatic stories about declines in home prices and therefore declines in city revenues.
In Southern California, there's an area called Ontario, California, and there's now a tent city there. It was one of these places that had a big run-up in prices, and now there's more homelessness than there used to be. So it sounds like at a time when these fortunes are changing for so many people, the cities are actually going to have more responsibility, rather than less revenue and more responsibility.
Right. That's the perfect storm that we tend to see happen for cities around the country when housing markets and economic conditions decline. You find yourself in situations where there are more people in need right at the time when you're seeing less revenue. And so this means that cities end up making some hard choices about what gets funded. They tend to want to protect their public safety services, those core sorts of services that they provide that are about people's safety. But that's not always something they can do. And it usually means that things that are outside of public safety are all on the table in terms of being cut. So all of those social services and human services that we think of cities providing that help those in need are on the table for cuts. And as you said, precisely at a time when they're seeing the numbers of folks who are in need go up.
So you're with the National League of Cities. What are you guys going to try to do to help these municipalities and to help the people, all of us who live in them?
Well, a number of different things. One is we're going to try to at least help shed some light on the fact that cities are going to be in need here and need some help. The stories about cities' revenues being down are only now coming to light, but we've been having this discussion about mortgage finance crises in this country for some time. So we'll try to shed some light on it so people know what's happening. We're the National League of Cities, and we're here in Washington, D.C., so we'll obviously focus on raising some attention with federal policymakers about the need to prop up and support local governments. There are a number of programs that the federal government uses in this regard, like the Community Development Block Grant Program, which is used by a lot of cities in the country to support local housing and development work. That needs to continue to be funded and, if anything, increased. We've heard the president start to talk about an economic stimulus package, perhaps, as something he will raise in his State of the Union address. Helping our nation's cities help the people in need certainly seems like it ought to be part of that stimulus package. And one question we all ought to be asking our presidential candidates is, why aren't they talking about this? We hear almost nothing in the presidential elections about issues of importance to our cities and our local communities. We hear instead lots of sort of big, you know, policy talk that's about things they might do if they were in charge of the federal government, but not about those things that really might help, you know, the people who in a community in an inner city.
Well, thanks a lot, Christopher.
Thank you.
Christopher Haney directs policy and research for the National League of Cities in Washington, D.C., and he was at our NPR studios in Washington.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Maybe upon a broken guitar.